We're dealing now with how badly did the scribes corrupt the text. This should be a shorter lecture. The last one I gave was something that I had revised and added a lot of new things to, and then, as is typical with me, I don't get to the point. I wrote a Greek grammar. It's 850 pages long. It took me 17 years to work on. It deals with Greek syntax, so it's the advanced grammar that's used at most schools, even liberal schools that teach New Testament Greek. And then a few years later, I wrote a short grammar, an abridgment of that. And that abridgment I wrote because of Bible colleges. They didn't want to read it, 850 pages in one semester, and Southern Baptist seminaries. So I wrote the short one because they'd use that, and I wanted them at least to get to the right view, I think, of syntax. And that second one was dedicated to my wife. She is constantly saying to me, wrap it up, get to the point, get to the point. And so all it says is to Patty, nothing else. And that, I got to the point. So that's what I'm going to try to do a little bit more this time. How badly did the scribes corrupt the scripture? Let me begin by telling you a story about a man named Brother Andrew. He was trained at a scriptorium in Dublin. And then this is, I think it was the 10th century. Then he was promoted to a monastery in Kilkenny, about 100 miles away. Now, Brother Andrew was one of these guys who was very, very detail-oriented. And not only could he not see the forest for the trees, he couldn't even see the trees for the leaves. I mean, he was really, really detail-oriented. He was a good scribe, though. He loved doing this. And so he came with a letter of recommendation, and in it, the abbot from the monastery, or the from the scriptorium, said, this man should just be copying manuscripts. Just put him in a cage and feed him under the door. You know, he's not real sociable, so have him do that. So, Brother Andrew comes in, meets the abbot now at this monastery, and the abbot said, okay, I have a manuscript for you to copy out. It's one of our bylaws that we follow in here in the monastery, and it hasn't been copied in a few hundred years. So we need to get some fresh copies. So Brother Andrew starts to copy now. And then a couple hours later, he knocks on the door of the abbot's office, and he said, do you have any older manuscripts than this? I'd like to compare them to earlier manuscripts. So he found one that's, you know, about 100 years older than this other one. So he started to copy that one out. And he said, do you have anything older than this? And the abbot looked at him and he said, we have the original manuscript, and it's locked up in a vault. Nobody has seen it in 300 years. It's 400 years old. But if you be extremely careful, I think you would be the right person to look at this. So it's locked up in this vault. They had to go down this labyrinthian path to get to the vault. There's a little desk in there and a lamp. Brother Andrew sits down and starts copying. And it wasn't 2 or 3 hours later, but it was 15 minutes later that the abbot heard knocks from about 15 of his monks, all of them. He opened the door. Father, this young man is going berserk. He's down in the vault, and he's going crazy down there. So the abbot and the rest of the monks went down there to see Brother Andrew, and he was weeping and pounding his fist on the desk. And he said, they left out the letter R. The abbot thought, this guy really is anal. Am I allowed to use that word here? Okay. Yeah. So he really is anal. That's the official description of Brother Andrew's condition. What do you mean they left out the letter R? The word is supposed to be celebrate. Okay, the guys in the back there, I'm not so sure you all got this joke at all. Are you from Tucson by any chance? You're not locals, right? Try to stay with me. You might understand some of these jokes. Okay. This is just to illustrate that textual criticism is important, sometimes down to the very letter, but that's rare.
All right.
Let's go back to what Dan Brown says in the Da Vinci Code just for fun. The Bible has evolved through countless translations, editions, and revisions. History has never had a definitive version of the book. Well, again, the master who is promoting this idea is Dr. Bart Ehrman. And I'm using a different quote from him this time because we're dealing with the quality of the variants, the nature of the variants, not the number of them. Towards the end of the book, he says, "The more I study the manuscript tradition of the New Testament, the more I realize just how radically the text had been changed over the years at the hands of the scribes. It would be wrong to say, as people sometimes do, that the changes in our text have no real bearing on what the text mean or on the theological conclusions that one draws from them." This is a bona fide scholar, a textual critic, and he's making a pretty bold statement. Now, I'll get to this in greater detail in the final lecture, but there's two attitudes, I think, that we as believers who also take history seriously need to avoid. The first one is radical skepticism. The Dan Browns and the Bart Ehrmans of this world and Muslims who think the New Testament that we have today was invented in the 4th century. This radical skepticism really is not grounded in history. And as I said earlier, if you compare the New Testament copies, we have more manuscripts and earlier manuscripts than any other classical writing. So if you're going to say we can't possibly tell what it said, then we need to kiss the Renaissance goodbye. The world did not change because they could not have trusted any of those ancient documents that were really far more recent than the New Testament. So I also said that we have about 1,000 times as many manuscripts of the New Testament as the average classical author. So you need to do this comparison when you're talking to these folks. Radical skepticism. We should avoid that at all costs because it's abandoning history. And the other attitude to avoid is absolute certainty. That's the one that Christians can succumb to. We'll get into that topic more in my final lecture, but I just want to tell you, stay away from the fringes. Neither one of these really is taking history seriously. All right. I also mentioned last time that we have about 138,162 words in the Greek New Testament, and the number of textual variants is more than 10 times the words in the New Testament. So my count includes all of these variants, including spelling variants, nonsense, errors, that kind of thing. Now, I want to give you another quick aside on the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts. You remember that I said our first goal is to digitally preserve these manuscripts. Our final goal is to determine the exact wording of the original New Testament. We not only do that by examining these digital images, which are approximately now, I think it's 100 times better than microfilm. That's how, the estimate that I've come up with. It's easier to read our images than it is to read the original manuscripts that we're taking pictures of. That's pretty astounding. You can blow it up to, 6 by 8 foot poster without any pixelation. That's what we're trying to do, get back to exactly the wording of the original text. Our earliest manuscripts are papyri, and all of those papyri are fragmentary. Our earliest manuscript of Mark's Gospel is P45, early 3rd century. This is at the Charles Beatty Museum in Dublin, Ireland. And we photographed this along with P46 and P47. P47, Gary, where are you? Back there? P47 is the oldest manuscript we have for its portions of Revelation. And we have not only photographs of it in our new publication, but we also have a transcription that lays out exactly what it says in the Greek text. Brand new work. So here's the oldest manuscript of Mark's Gospel right here, 32 leaves. And here we are in Mark chapter 8. What we could do not only with these digital images is to see what could not be seen before, but we also see just parts of letters now that we could not see before, and we can make out exactly what those letters were. So watch this very closely. I'm sure that just thrilled you to the bones, right? That's Mark 8, I think it's 22. And what it says in other Greek manuscripts is they came to Bethsaida. This manuscript, however, doesn't say they came. It says he came. Notice the Greek letters are in bold about 10 lines up from the bottom. I wish I had a pointer so you could... Yeah, you can't see that from here. I apologize. So I'm going to superimpose English on this. If we had the full page, this is what it would look like. And what it says here is, and he came to Bethsaida rather than they, meaning Jesus and his disciples. This has never been seen before in this particular papyrus. Everyone thought it said they came to Bethsaida. What's the significance between he came and they came? And it was Jesus and his disciples. Well, it's not great, but it is subtle. And it's important in that sense. When Jesus and his disciples go someplace or are mentioned together, often it's, and he did this, or and he ate dinner with these people, when it's really more than just he. And when you have a compound subject, the first named subject, or Jesus and his disciples, or something like that, the first named subject is more prominent than the second named subject, one of the rules of Greek grammar. We see this in when Jesus talks about, you have this in Moses and the prophets. Well, Moses is listed first. He's more important than the prophets, more prominent. So what we have in this statement, we also see, most interestingly, in John chapter 2, verse 1, where Jesus and his disciples came to Bethsaida. The verb came is Jesus came and his disciples. Now, and his disciples properly is not the subject. It's a singular verb. He came. That passage goes on. It's the wedding at Cana, and you remember that Jesus changed the water into wine. It was approximately, in our day, it would be considered about 750 bottles of wine. Good stuff. That's a lot. You'll probably, that'll last you the night or something like that, I would think. So, why did they run out of wine? Well, here's a plausible hypothesis, and it may well be true, actually. They ran out of wine because Jesus' disciples were not invited. But he was invited, and these guys downed all of it. They were fishermen. What do fishermen do? You know fishermen and beer. You know, it's the same ancient world, fishermen and wine would go together. So they may well have finished off the wine before it was due. And so we see that in that subtlety in John chapter 2, verse 1. He came rather than his disciples. But it says, and Jesus came and his disciples to Cana of Galilee. So when you see, and he came to Bethsaida, just by itself, when it's he and his disciples, is putting prominence on Jesus just a little bit more subtly than just they came. So it's a slight difference, two-letter difference in the Greek. This is the kind of stuff that occupies textual critics' minds because we don't have a social life. We don't have a sense of humor that we know of. You know, we just like to study these minute details. And CSNTM discovered that one word. Not the most significant passage, but that's the kind of thing we're doing. By the way, that animation was done by my third son who got his degree at University of Texas in film. And he's worked now on, I think, 18 different Hollywood or London movies as an editor. So he did a fine job animating it once we could see those letters. That's all it could possibly be. It could not be seen that way with the older photographs. The only published photographs before this were done in the 1930s. And now CSNTM has published, in conjunction with Hendrickson Publishing House, New Testament papyri, and we have two volumes. They contain pictures that are the exact same size as the papyri. And that's why we have a large volume, even though on some pages it might be just a couple of fragments, something like that. The volume has to be big enough to contain the very largest image. That's why it's like this. We photographed these images, these manuscripts, on a black background and a white background. They were so precious at the Chester Beatty Library, not Charles Beatty. At the Chester Beatty Library, they were so precious that they were brought down to us by an armed guard. And there was always somebody from the library staff in there helping us. It was a very crowded room. They added air conditioning to this basement. And Dublin got up to 80 degrees one day, and they had a health alert because that's dangerous for your health to be out in the sun more than 20 minutes. 80 degrees. I bet you can't relate to that too well. So when they were bringing them out, all of these are in individual plates, double plated, so it keeps the dust out. That plating was done in 1929. And they found out how much the stuff was insured for. Each page, each leaf of these manuscripts was worth at least $1 million. And this manuscript that we started with, P46, has 86 of the original 104 leaves. And that is perhaps as early as AD 200. So Hendrickson published this two-volume work. One has all of the images against a black background. The other has exactly the same papyri against a white background. Because white reveals some things that black doesn't. Black reveals some things that white doesn't. So this is now for sale. It's only $400. It'd be a great gift to give to your pastor, though. And if you work through us, I'm sure we can get it a little bit cheaper. That's the kind of advances that we're making today. We have found thousands of differences from the transcription of these three earlier papyri based on the images that we now have. Thousands of differences. Thousands of differences per each papyrus. And we are working on the transcriptions. We've got just the one on Revelation done, but the others, we've taken years to work on P45. You know, you saw that page, it looks like shredded wheat with ink on it. I mean, that's where how difficult it is to read some of this. So, this is a critical thing in what we're doing. Now, back to the nature of the variants. That is, how badly did the scribes corrupt the New Testament? Well, what kind of variants, the kinds of variants are there? Over 99% make virtually no difference at all. For example, movable new. It should have an A in there, but never mind. A movable new. A new is a letter in the Greek alphabet. It sounds like our N, and in the capital letter it looks like N. But a movable new was new at the end of a word where it was not necessary. So you could have the verb he is spelled with E-S-T-I or E-S-T-I-N. That's why it's called a movable new. It can move. And these scribes would often remove the new or add it as at their whim. It changes absolutely nothing. It's just exactly like us saying an apple, a book. Or if you're in Tucson, a book, a apple. You know, they don't know anything there. So, this is the most common spelling difference we have among our manuscripts. Nobody wastes time talking about more than I just have now. Textual critics are far more interested in the ones that are more significant. So, we have this movable new. And as I mentioned before, more than 70% of all textual differences are spelling or nonsense words. And these are also the easiest to detect, as we noted with the preamble to the Constitution. In John chapter 9, we see an example of this. The oldest manuscripts for John 9, which I think are giving us exactly what John wrote, spell a particular verb three different ways. Now, for those of you who have some Greek, this is a third-person singular, first aorist, active, indicative of the verb anoigo. In the space of eight verses, John spells exactly the same word three different ways. It's like saying, he dove off the the diving board. He dived off the diving board. Both of those are acceptable English. Different spellings for the same word. This is what John has done. So he's a creative speller. Now, my brother is also a very creative speller. I learned about how to make mistakes in spelling by just listening and reading what he would write to this day. He wasn't a creative speller by choice. Just not very good at spelling. And sometimes he would send documents to me that needed to be spelled correctly. And one of them was a check that he wrote out to me. He spelled his own name incorrectly. His own name. That was hard to cash. Maybe he did that one on purpose. I'm not sure. All right. A question for Greek geeks. How many ways are there to say John loves Mary in Greek? Don't answer it. Just think through this with me. Here's the things you would need to consider. Word order differences. In Greek, you could put those words in any order you want. We know that it says John loves Mary, even if the Greek puts it in the order of Mary loves John, by the case endings on those words. We know what the subject is, we know what the object is by the case endings. The Greek definite article, or the word the in Greek, sometimes occurs with proper names, sometimes it doesn't. We don't know why. It doesn't change anything about our doctrines whatsoever. And there's going to be differences in spelling. For example, the name John in Greek is Ioannes or Ioannes. That is two N's, two N's, or one N. So here's the ways you can say John loves Mary in Greek. You need to write this down. It will show up on the test. There's eight different ways to say John loves Mary using exactly the same verb. No, there's another eight ways. And there may be even more to come in my final lecture. But just leave it at that. We've got well over a dozen ways to say John loves Mary without changing the meaning at all. Just a slight difference in the emphasis. Well, Bart Ehrman said we could go on nearly forever talking about specific places in which the texts of the New Testament came to be changed, either accidentally or intentionally. The examples are not just in the hundreds, but in the thousands. Yeah, he's right. But, all right, if we can say John loves Mary a dozen different ways without changing the meaning, the number of variants we have, 1,000, 1,000,000, it just doesn't matter, 1.5 million. What matters is the nature of these variants, and so that's what I want to get into now. I'm going to give you some illustrations of textual variants in the New Testament. One way to think about the variants is this. You can group them into four different groups. The first category would be not meaningful and not viable. When I say it's not meaningful, that means it's not going to change the way we read the text. The difference between Jesus and the Lord in John 4:1 is actually a very meaningful difference. It doesn't change our theology, but it's significant in other ways. So it's not meaningful. It doesn't really change the meaning of the text, like different ways to spell John loves Mary. And it's not viable. That's going to be quite a few of our manuscripts have readings that are neither meaningful nor viable. What do I mean by viable? I mean a reading that has some decent plausibility of going back to the original. Sometimes we think the original is found in just one or two manuscripts, but they are old enough and they have such a good pedigree that most scholars would say, yeah, I think this is what the original text says. Well, the third category is not viable, but they are meaningful. So if you have stuff that it could not possibly go back to the original, it might be found in one late manuscript, but it changes the meaning. That would be a significant variant. But it would not be anything that we would ever think would be possibly going back to the original wording. And then the fourth category is the one that scholars are all interested in, and this is the one that guys like Bart Ehrman and others really address. They talk about the thousands of variants that are out there, and then they talk about a few meaningful and viable variants, and the implication in your own mind is those meaningful and viable variants, that must be a very large category. It must be those thousands of places. Well, here's the actual way to construct this. You see the four categories: not viable, meaningful, viable, and not meaningful. Can you see that up there? It's hard. You've got meaningful on the top. On the left, you got not viable. Viable on the right. And the bottom is not meaningful. So we've got these four different categories. And notice what is less than 1%, those that are both meaningful and viable. Less than 1% of all of our texture variants are meaningful and viable. Is it thousands? No, it's actually not. In fact, it's far less than 1%. We'll deal with that later. Don't worry about getting the specifics down now, but I think that's significant. When you juxtapose, well, there's thousands and thousands of variants, over a million variants, and then you say, here are some of the readings that you find in those thousands of variants. No, these are not just some of the readings. These are the significant ones that are also viable. And that's, they're mixing apples and oranges when they're talking. Is this clear? I hope it's clear, because this is a critical point for you to understand about dealing with texture variants. Now, I'm going to give you examples of each. First of all, not meaningful and not viable. We already used the illustration of we the people of the United States in order to form a more perfect onion. I did use that before, right? Nope. Okay, this is the first time. All right. If you saw a manuscript that said that, copy of the preamble to the Constitution, you'd say, wait, a scribe made a mistake. He didn't mean onion. He meant cucumber, of course. No, it's the word union. The earliest scribes, Ehrman likes to point out, were not professionally trained scribes in writing with calligraphy, with good handwriting. And so he claims they made the worst mistakes. I have responded to him by saying, first of all, the kinds of mistakes these oldest manuscripts make are almost always the easiest ones to detect. That's because they were not intentional. You can find those. You can figure those out pretty easily. Why is it that they were not professional scribes? And what's the implication? What we find in New Testament manuscripts through the first 5 centuries is something that's truly bizarre. When you wrote in literature, in Greek literature, you did not write out the numbers. Now, we have Arabic numbers. Greek uses Greek letters to represent those numbers. So it could be alpha with a line over it means number 1. Iota with a line means 10. And then you've got others that mean 600. And that's how we get to 666 in Revelation 13:18. Those would be written by professional scribes. They would write out the word. So if I said in Revelation 13:18, the number of the beast is 666, or 666, I'd write it out as words if I'm a professionally trained scribe. Only one other manuscript, I believe, has ever been discovered that does not write out the names but uses the letter abbreviations, other manuscript of any literature. But in the New Testament manuscripts through these first 5 centuries, there are a number of manuscripts that do this. What does that tell us? It tells us that these may not have been trained professional scribes, but they were trained professional bookkeepers and accountants, CPAs, if you will. They did number crunching all day long. They used the abbreviations. And so Ehrman, again, I think, it does a bait and switch. And I don't think he was conscious of this. The fact is that our earliest scribes were often not professionally trained scribes, but they also made the kinds of mistakes that are not intentional. How many CPAs do you know that just have creativity oozing out their veins? Now, maybe you're one of them here, so I don't want to step on those toes. But most of them, they're steady, solid people. They know how to do the number crunching. They help you fill out your taxes, this kind of thing. So it was discovered that just the New Testament manuscripts, almost alone among all of literature with just one exception, have sometimes these numbers written as numbers rather than written out. And that tells us they were done not by professionally trained scribes, but by those who were trained as accountants, bean counters, if you will. Now, when Ehrman made this argument in 2011 in our second debate, I thought, let me see what our earliest scribes did. And I knew about them not writing out the numbers in some of these manuscripts. So a student from Dallas Seminary wanted to do his master's thesis with me, and I suggested this as a master's topic. His name is Zachary Cole. He got his PhD at Edinburgh, and his master's thesis was dealing on these numbers in the early manuscripts, and he expanded on that for his PhD. Zach Cole is now teaching at RTS, Reformed Theological Seminary in Florida. Very, very fine scholar. And so I asked him to do this to answer Ehrman. It's not stated that he's answering Ehrman, but what he discovered is that these early scribes who were accountants were just as accurate as those who were professionally trained scribes. With the difference being they're not going to add things intentionally or take things away intentionally. Does that make sense to you all? I think that's a very significant point. Those earliest manuscripts made mistakes that are easy to detect. So, we even have this later on, not with numbers, but in 1 Thessalonians 2:7, if you want to, you could turn to your Bible in these passages as I go through a few of them. Paul says, although we could have imposed our weight as apostles of Christ, instead we became little children, or we became gentle among you. Your New Testament translations will have it both ways. The NET Bible, of which I was the senior New Testament editor, was the first translation to have we became little children among you. The NIV followed suit shortly after that. All of the translations had we became gentle among you. Well, is there some difference in Greek that's so minor it could be a mistake? Yeah. Little children is the word napioi, and gentle is the word apioi. Anew, at the front of the word, is the only difference between these two. So napioi versus apioi, if you want to write out the Greek. So, and the word before it is eganathemen. It ends with a new. It might be easy to miss that new and put apioi here. Well, I'm not going to deal with whether this is which word is authentic. But as I was studying this, I noticed one very late manuscript that did not have napioi. It did not have apioi. And it's all by itself. It has hippoi, the word horses. We became horses among you. I think this guy was a USC Trojans fan. I'm not sure, but that's remarkable. We would call that not a meaningful variant and not a viable variant, right? Yeah, it would change the text, but it makes such nonsense that it really would not be meaningful. It's a mistake the scribe made. Now, here's an illustration just for Greek students of a reading that is neither meaningful nor viable. John 1:30 in the Greek text says, "After me is coming a man," John the Baptist says. Codex L, a very important manuscript with a lot of mistakes in it, from the 8th century, says, "After me is coming not a ner, but a heir." That's the word heir in Greek. Man versus heir. Once again, it's because of a missing nu in the middle. You see, A-N-E-R, that's man, or adult male. A-E-R is the word heir. So that's a variant that is neither meaningful as nonsense, nor viable. What's interesting is if you know anything about Gnosticism, then you know they might like a reading like this because they thought the material world was bad. So maybe John the Baptist is saying Jesus is not physical at all. Maybe it could be a Gnostic intrusion into the text. I think the scribe just made a mistake because he does that everywhere. Okay, now, what about the not meaningful but viable texture problems? Things that are like spelling differences, transposition of words, the presence or absence of the article with proper names. All sorts of things fit this category. So, we've talked about this already. Not meaningful but viable. And so let's
I don't need to give any more illustrations of that. Third, not viable, but meaningful. Well, the best illustration I can come up with is the Textus Receptus that stands behind the King James Bible, based on very late manuscripts. 11th century was the earliest, while as today our oldest manuscripts come from the 2nd century, and based basically on 9 manuscripts. So there's some variants in there that are not viable at all. How did this Greek New Testament come about? It was published by Desiderius Erasmus, a Dutchman. Came out on March 1st, 1516, 20 months prior to the start of the Reformation. He was a Dutch humanist who laid the egg that Luther would hatch, namely the Reformation. As I said before, the Reformation never could have started without Luther having Erasmus's Greek New Testament in his hands. Erasmus became the greatest scholar of the 16th century of ancient Greek and Latin. And yet, he did not even start studying Greek until he was 31 years old. So, there are some problems with his Greek New Testament. The first edition, Erasmus confessed that it was thrown together rather than edited. The second edition, he did not have any Greek manuscripts. I'm sorry, the first edition still. In some places, he did not have any Greek manuscripts for some of the passages. We'll show a couple of them that are significant. And so, why does he put it in there? Well, he thinks more material goes in, so he found it in Latin manuscripts, perhaps. Latin translations of the New Testament that have been fairly corrupted. When he got to the very last leaf of Revelation, the lone manuscript he had for Revelation, which he borrowed, did not have that last leaf. It's like a paperback book. You know, you probably have a slip and slide or something like that here. Now, I grew up in Newport Beach, so I have the sand. And if you go down to the beach, you read that book, sand beats it up, and it might be thick. And if you just abuse it even just a little bit, say you're reading a mystery novel, by the time you get to the last page, the whodunit, you discover that last page is gone. Well, this happened. It can only happen in a codex, because a codex is a bound form. It's not a roll. If it were a roll, like Revelation was originally written on, then that last section would be the most protected section, because you roll it up from the end to the front. The front of it would be the least protected. But in a codex, that those outer leaves, both the front and the back, are susceptible to loss. So Erasmus is looking at this Greek New Testament. He's panicking, trying to get his Greek New Testament published before the Spaniards could get theirs done. So when he gets to Revelation chapter 22, verses 16 through 22, there's no Greek New Testament. So what does Erasmus do? Well, he back translates from a late Latin manuscript these 6 verses. 7 verses, what is it? Anyway, back translates them from Latin into Greek, and he creates 20 textual variants that were not known in any Greek New Testament manuscripts at all. After this time, there's now 3 or 4 of them. Why? Because you had scribes copying out Erasmus's Greek New Testament. That's why we have some now, but it was not seen in any other manuscripts. You say, oh, what a dumbbell. How can he make 20 differences that are not even found in the Greek text? Well, if any of you know Greek, and I think Gary would be a great candidate for this, let's say he grabbed Revelation 22, 16 through 22, and you back translate from whatever English translation you want to use into Greek. I bet you'd make a lot more than 20 variants, because there's so many ways to express something in Greek. So there's one significant variant here that showed up also in the King James Bible. But the King James, these last 6 verses of Revelation, it has exactly what Erasmus had in that first edition. In verse 19,
If any man shall take away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part out of the book of life. All the other Greek manuscripts have the tree of life instead of the book of life. This is what the King James Bible has, the book of life. So all the others have tree, this has book. How did this happen? Well, the Greek word for tree is xulu, and the word for book is biblu. Besides the lu ending, there's really not anything to compare. It's not a mistake that would be easily made. However, in Latin, you have li that begins and o that ends. Right in the middle, you got libro for ligno. Ligno is tree, libro is book. And that's how the King James translators have it. They have book of life, because Erasmus used a late manuscript that had book of life instead of tree of life. You see the difference? And that's based on absolutely nothing. A late Latin manuscript that doesn't even reflect the best of the Latin tradition. The most notorious reading of the King James Version is known as the Comma Johannium. It's 1 John chapter 5, verses 7 and 8. And this passage is the Trinitarian formula, speaking about there are three who are one in heaven, three in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Spirit, and these three are one. Well, here's a little bit of interesting history on this. In the King James Bible, following Erasmus' text again, there are three that bear witness or record in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one. And there are three that bear witness in earth, the Spirit, the water, and the blood, and these three agree in one. That's the King James Bible. Most modern translations here do not have the words that are underlined. They simply have four. There are three that testify, the Spirit, and the water, and the blood. And these three are one or in agreement. How did this get into the King James Bible? Well, a little history on Erasmus. His first edition, the Trinitarian formula, was not in that because he said, I did not put into my Greek New Testament anything that was not found in Greek manuscripts. He never told anybody about the last leaf of Revelation. That was discovered long after he lived. So this is a little bit disingenuous. It was the Catholic Church that was putting pressure on him. They said, this is part of the Latin Bible tradition. You need to have it in your Greek New Testament. After a while, those in Leuven, Belgium, were calling him a heretic. And in the Council of Trent in 1535, they said, burn all of Erasmus's books. He was a Catholic priest. He was also the most prolific writer in the 16th century, published about 200 volumes. He was at the time, and for many, many centuries afterwards, the most published author in the world. That honor now goes to Jacob Neusner, who was a professor at Brown University. And Neusner was a Hebrew professor. He was, I'd say, anti-Christian. He published 600 books. He's dead now. I'm sure that's what killed him. But there's a joke that goes around in academic circles. A professor calls up and wants to speak to Professor Neusner, and the secretary says, I'm sorry, sir, but he's writing a book right now. That's okay. I'll wait. That's how much he was, just seemed to be cranking them out. But Erasmus does this first edition. He doesn't have the Trinitarian formula because he couldn't find any Greek manuscripts that had. So here's the proof. What you see here, both in Greek and Latin, is there are three who testify, the Spirit, the water, and the blood, and these three agree in one. The Greek on the left side, the Latin on the right side. First edition, it accurately represented the Greek. Now, in his second edition, published in 1519, he corrected the most egregious errors. And this was the Greek New Testament that Luther had in his hands, the 1519 edition of Erasmus. This is why, in the German history of the Bible, they really didn't have problems with this passage and have King James only people or Luther only people saying, you left out the Trinity. And you guys are denying the Trinity. You're all heretics because you left this verse out deliberately because you're anti-Trinitarian. Nothing could be farther from the truth. But Luther's text did not have the Trinitarian formula. So there was this great outcry from ecclesiastical authorities that the Trinitarian formula in 1 John 5:7 was not in Erasmus' text. Erasmus said, "I didn't put it in because I didn't find any Greek manuscripts that had it." Now, it has been said, even by Bruce Metzger of Princeton Seminary, that Erasmus made a promise that if he could find any Greek New Testament manuscript that had this in its text, then he would put it in. He never made such a promise. But he did make a defense that "I didn't put it in because there were no Greek New Testament manuscripts that happened." Now, what's interesting is, as I said already, this is somewhat disingenuous because there's other places he had no Greek, like Revelation 22, and yet he wrote out the Greek text from that text. Now, during this time, a scribe working at Oxford University seems to have made to order a complete New Testament manuscript, which Erasmus got wind of. Once this scribe, we're pretty sure what manuscript he copied from when he got into the general letters. That Greek manuscript is 10th century. I had a chance at Oxford earlier this year to look at this very place, and the comma Johannium is not there in this 10th century manuscript. The Greek text that the scribe was writing out followed that 10th century manuscript to a T until it got to 1 John 5:7. Then it put in a translation from late manuscripts, this Trinitarian formula. So Erasmus heard about it, and he felt obligated to put this into his third edition. So he puts the Trinitarian formula in his text, 1 John 5:7, because of this ecclesiastical pressure. The scribe was named Roy. And this manuscript, the famous Codex Montfortianus, is now at Trinity College, Dublin. And if you were to hold it upright with its spine laying on the back, you hold it upright, it will almost naturally fall open at 1 John chapter 5. It's been looked at so many times. And if you look at it, the manuscript is clean as a whistle till you get to 1 John. Then you start getting some smudges and more till you get to chapter 5. And then it's lots of dirt and wax drippings from the candles they used to look at. So this manuscript was made to order, and Erasmus puts it in his third edition. Since that time, only 8 other manuscripts have been found to have this wording. This is not a viable variant. It's not possible that it goes back to the original. All of those manuscripts are from the 11th century or later. One of them I rediscovered. Bruce Metzger, in his textual commentary, says there's 8 Greek manuscripts that have this, but he only gives 7, and so he accidentally left one out. And I found the 9th manuscript in Munich. It was already known to exist 100 years before, but Metzger apparently forgot about that too. So there are 9 manuscripts to this day that have the comma Johannium in them. The oldest is from the 11th century, but the date of the comma is not 11th century. It's a marginal note that is added many centuries later. The earliest manuscript we have that has it in the text is from the 14th century, I believe. The one I saw, I absolutely know that it was written after 1551, 16th century manuscript. How do I know that specific of a date? That's because it has a marginal note. It puts it at the top and then draws an arrow where it belongs in the text. It says V7 and then V8. Verse 7, verse 8. Verse numbers were not invented until 1551. And so for the scribe to put that in, same scribe, I think, it obviously was added after 1551. Okay, so those are some meaningful but not viable textual variants. Let's look at the last category, meaningful and viable. This is the one that gets all the press time. But as I've said, I want to underscore this point. On the one hand, these scholars talk about there's thousands of textual variants. And they also say we don't have copies of copies. We were waiting for copies of copies of copies of copies, which is overstated, and we talked about that already.
But on the one hand, they'll talk about thousands of variants, hundreds of thousands of variants, over a million variants. But when they actually are getting to the places where the meaning of the text changes to some degree with viable variants, it's less than 1% of all of those textual variants. Now, this chart is not made to scale. The dot should actually be smaller. So the smallest group of variants are those that are both meaningful and viable. And viable means it has a good chance of being authentic. And the number actually is less than 1/10 of 1% of all textual variants are both meaningful and viable. So these scholars are talking about all of them and then applying it to this 1/10 of 1%. But it's a bait and switch, switch technique. You notice what they're doing. They're not talking about the hundreds of places, and there are hundreds, about 1,000 places, maybe as many as 1,400 places, and that are meaningful and viable. But we're not talking about thousands. And in those places, the meaning can change, sometimes only in Greek. There's two different words for and, the word kai and the word de. De is a postpositive, means it cannot come before the sentence or the clause that it's in front of. It has to be second or later in the clause. So, and Jesus went out. In the Greek, it could be used with kai. Kai would come first. Kai, Jesus went out. If de were used, it would be de. It would be Jesus, de, went out. It's postpositive. It means and. But you won't see the difference in English, but there is a little bit of difference in Greek in terms of how an author is structuring his argument and how important this particular point is. That counts as a meaningful and viable textual variant. Probably the most common of those meaningful and viable ones. But let me give some that are a little bit more meaningful than that. The vast majority of textual variants involve just a few letters or just one letter. But there are two passages that are more than these others. There's about 15 places in the manuscripts where a verse or more is in question, whether to have it in there or not. You could look at John chapter 5, verses 3b through 4 in your modern translation. We won't do that. But it speaks about the angel of the Lord stirring up the waters before the layman could get into the pool of Bethesda and get in to get healed. Found only in later manuscripts. And in our modern translations, you read John chapter 5, verse 1, 2, 3a, and then verse 5. Skips 3b in verse 4. Well, doesn't that prove that modern translations are taking out the text? No, this numbering system was invented in 1551 based on Erasmus's text. So unfortunately, we're removing a text that does not have sufficient basis to really be considered authentic, although it has some viability. Some scholars hold to it. But there's about 15 places where there's a verse or more that's in question, and there are only two that are longer than two verses, and they're quite a bit longer. And they carry a lot of emotional baggage. So I'll conclude with talking about these. The first is Mark chapter 16, verses 9 through 20. It happens to be 12 verses long. In your New Testament, you'll read in verse 8, the angel told the women to go and tell Jesus' disciples to meet him in Galilee, for he has risen. And it ends and said, but they did nothing because they were afraid. Period. What a downer to the end of the gospel. In reality, I think Mark intended to end it there, because all the way through the gospel, Jesus commands people not to speak about him, commands demons not to speak about him, and the reverse happens. Now they are commanded to speak, and they don't speak. So it's irony in the end. But here's the point, I think, about this, and I've published on this. The early readers of Mark's gospel, living in Rome, were coming under persecution, as Christians are almost always persecuted somewhere in the world that's especially an anti-Christian place like Rome. And Mark was sent to Rome. So, Mark's gospel, he's trying to encourage these readers to live their lives in fearsome devotion to Jesus Christ. So when he gets to the end of the gospel, it's as if you're reading along and there's nothing there to read. It's almost like, and they were afraid, and then you're saying, and what else, and what else? Mark wants the reader to step into the sandals of the original readers and work out the rest of Mark's gospel in their own lives. They need to tell others that Jesus is risen, and they need to live out their faith in such a way that they are fearless in their commitment to Jesus Christ in the midst of persecution. So, because there was no resurrection seen in Mark 16, verses 1 through 8, Jesus is raised from the dead. The angel tells the women that he rose from the dead. But because there's no resurrection appearances of Jesus in Mark 16, scribes had a difficult problem with it. So what do? They've got to add something that speaks about his appearances. And so they add verses 9 through 20. And what is the most troubling here is verses 17, 18, and a little bit of 19 and 20. 17. These signs will accompany those who believe. In my name they will drive out demons. They will speak in new languages, tongues. They will pick up snakes with their hands, and whatever poison they drink will not harm them. They will place their hands on the sick, and they will be well. After the Lord Jesus had spoken to them, he was taken up into heaven and sat down at the right hand of God. They went out and proclaimed everywhere while the Lord worked with them and confirmed the word through the accompanying signs. Now, this is almost surely not authentic. Those last 12 verses are found in the vast majority of manuscripts. Our two earliest ones, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, for this passage that are the earliest, don't have these words. And in the 4th century, the beginning of the 4th century, Eusebius, who's creating this Bible for the capital city, Constantinople, makes a comment about this ending. He says, most of the manuscripts I've ever seen do not have anything past verse 8. I'm using modern parlance, verse 8, after they were afraid. In a very few, I have found it, but he did not think it was authentic. At the end of the 4th century, we get Jerome, who's doing the Latin Vulgate, and he writes the great majority of Greek manuscripts. Now he's restricting it to Greece, to Greek manuscripts, do not have anything past verse 8, but a few do. The next century, a man by the name of Victor of Antioch wrote a commentary on Mark. It's the only commentary on Mark that's written in the first millennium. And what he discusses is the same problem. He says, about half the manuscripts have it, half the manuscripts don't. You see what's happening is over time, more and more manuscripts are having this reading. And one of the fundamental principles that scribes followed was, if in doubt, don't take it out. If in doubt, put it in. You see two manuscripts, one that ends at verse 8, another that has these 12 verses. By all means, put those verses in. After all, you're getting paid by the line, so you might as well do it that way. So, Victor of Antioch said, but I believe that the longer ending is original. Very popular commentary. And from the 6th century on, all of a sudden, this becomes the majority reading. There were other endings to Mark's gospel that were shorter and not nearly as poetic as this. And nobody would put those words in if this longer and almost poetic passage was already in the manuscripts. So, let me sum up on this. What do we lose if these verses are not authentic? Well, first of all, let me tell you what you lose if they are authentic. Maybe an arm. Sorry, bad joke. But a lot of these Christian groups in the Appalachian Mountains and some parts of Kentucky and Tennessee would swear on the long ending. This is authentic. And they still, to this day, bring snakes venomous snakes into their worship services. A couple of my students went to visit one of these pastors during the summer. And, they're everywhere in the Appalachians. And they asked him, "Do you really use venomous snakes in your services?" He said, "Yes, of course." He's sitting in a rocking chair. And he pulls out this box underneath his rocking chair, opens the lid, and grabs a snake by the neck. Like this one. I am deathly afraid of snakes. I'm not going to stay there when he pulls that thing out. The evidence strongly suggests that verses 17 and 18 actually were not a major problem for these church writers. The problem was there is no resurrection appearance. So we need to not only add that, but add some colorful things that are taken from the Gospel of Matthew and from the book of Acts and pump it up just a little bit. So, you might lose an arm or even a nose. That's what you lose if you believe that's authentic. And you live in Appalachia. That would be painful. Okay, there's another passage that's 12 verses long that I would say whenever I talk about these two passages, people will, I'll ask them, if you had the long ending of Mark's gospel as authentic and the other passage as inauthentic, or one of these two, you can only pick one of the two, which one would you put in your Bible? Well, the other passage is John chapter 7, verse 53 through 8:11, the story of the woman caught in adultery. I would have to say this is one of my favorite passages that's not in the Bible. And the evidence against it is significantly stronger than the evidence against Mark 16, 9 through 20. As a textual critic, if you had to argue for one of these on the basis of the historical evidence, you'd have to say Mark 16 goes in the Bible, John 7, 53 through 8:11 does not. And yet, we want this passage in our Bible, and we don't want the other one. We have to follow the evidence, even if we come to decisions that we don't like. Scholars today are not trying to stir up the pot and find passages that deny the Trinity or something like that. They are simply following the evidence, the trail of what the early manuscripts say, what the church fathers at that time say, and looking at different evidence to realize this verse is not actually in the Greek text. These passages don't stay here. It's just those two that are 12 verses long. So what if we lose? What do we lose if these verses are not authentic? Do we have resurrection appearances in the other Gospels? Yes, of course we do. Only Mark doesn't. Do we have other places in the Gospels where Jesus shows tenderness to women and forgives sins? Mark chapter 2, John chapter 4, Luke chapter 7, the passages can go on and on, where he forgives a person for their sins and even a woman. So, we're not losing anything, but we have a lot of emotional baggage to this passage. I heard a sermon one time at the church that we were members of for several years. The pastor said, he preached on this passage. He said, "I know it's not in the oldest manuscripts. I know so far we don't have evidence that it goes back to the original, but I'm going to preach on it anyway." And he said, "Let's pray that some early manuscripts will be found that have this passage." I don't think that's a proper way to handle the text. When I taught on John's Gospel in Sunday school, I knew this would be a problem. With 100 people in there, surely there were some new Christians. And so before I got to John 7:53, I spent 2 weeks talking about textual criticism and the principles of it, how we do it, and how we arrive at the results. The next week, when we were back at John 7:53 and following, I only casually mentioned these 12 verses are almost surely not authentic, so we actually begin with verse 12. John 7:52 through 8:12 connect. Take out John 7:53 through 8:11, and you're going to read the Gospel of John the way he meant it to be read. If somebody added several lines to my Greek grammar without telling me, I would be very offended, and that would not be what I authored. An author wants to protect his literary rights, and John is a beautiful artist with the Greek language. I call him, I think he's the Ernest Hemingway of Greek writers. Hemingway could use short words that had a profound impact. One church father said, not about Hemingway, but about John, that John's writings are simple enough that a child could wade in this river, and they're profound enough that an elephant would have to swim. It's both. The other reason John is like Ernest Hemingway is because he too was a fisherman, and Hemingway didn't hold back on liquor. So John may have been like that to start with. Well, what really is at stake in the variants that are meaningful and viable? Is there anything more than emotional baggage? I'd love for this passage to be authentic, but I can't put my stake there. Is any doctrine at stake? What about the virgin birth? What about the purpose of the resurrection, which I will be speaking about tomorrow in church on an exposition of Romans chapter 5, verses 6 through 8? What about angels? What about miracles? Did Jesus do the miracles that are attributed to him? What about prophecy? Are these things only found in later manuscripts? The deity of Christ, really important. Is that only found in the later manuscripts? Doesn't go back to the original? Well, there are people who say so. But that's what we'll discuss in our final lecture, which we'll have plenty of time for Q&A.